What do lovers of a democracy do when they share a country with people who are explicitly anti-democratic? How does a divided people build a government based on compromise when they won't even listen to each other? Today, we put questions like these to Vermont State Representative Mike Merwicki. Mike shares his hopeful take on democracy, lessons learned from his service, stories of fascist radio priests from the 1930s, and wisdom from Ireland's history of the Troubles. I've known Mike for years as a calm, constructive voice in local politics. He's the type of guy who walks into the local diner and knows everybody there. As busy as he is, he always takes time to give a friendly greeting and ask how your kids are doing. Sure, you might find him at the podium at town meeting, but you're just as likely to find him in the kitchen, washing dishes after the community supper. The day after the inauguration, Mike was kind enough to sit down with me at Putney's Sweet Spot Cafe before heading up to the State House to talk about the democracy he loves. Do you have a democracy origin story? Is there a moment that you knew that you wanted to get into politics and public service? How'd you get here?
Well, thanks, first of all, for doing this. You know, I love what you're doing with your podcast. I'd say my public service extends beyond when I became an elected public servant. I mean, I've worked for nonprofits most of my life, serving the public in various ways. Before the legislature, one of the things that led to it was when I worked for an agency in Putney called Putney Family Services. It was a small community nonprofit that started at the school. It was actually started by the school counselor there, who was trying to bring together people to help address concerns which weren't necessarily educational, but which were impacting the education of our children. It was as simple as kids coming to school hungry, with clothes that were appropriate for the time and place, and then expanded to the child care, aftercare, and then eventually we expanded to where we had a weekly health clinic at the local doctor's office one night a week. We did community outreach for people who were in crisis, referral services. And during that time, I'd done some advocacy at the State House. Our clinic was part of a group of 10 free health clinics around the state that had a coalition and looked to the legislature in the state to help provide funding for these services. And I'd done some advocacy work there to try and increase funding for what we don't have here, which is we don't have a healthcare system. And within that, there was some folks who suggested I could increase my advocacy for these concerns to run for elected office. And I was fortunate enough to get elected, and that was 18 years ago. Continues to be a real honor to be able to serve our community and to look at it as elected public service. I don't consider myself a political animal the way some people look at politics as like playing 3D chess. But also, moving to Vermont to start a family, I became aware of what democracy meant in Vermont and in Putney through town meeting. You know, there are very few places that still have any sort of direct democracy. And coming to Putney, which has a town meeting, it was just refreshing to see that people had voices. They had a direct say in what happened in their town, and there was a structure for that. I could see the roots of our national democracy, though we have a representative democracy. Earlier, I'd read some of de Tocqueville's writings about his tours of the U.S. back. And thought these were great ideas, but here they are still being practiced in New England. And, you know, town meeting isn't what it was, and who knows what it will be in the future, but right now it still works to a degree, and I think democracy still works, even though the whole idea of self-government is still pretty new in the history of humankind, and it's still not the norm around the world. So it's important, I think, for the United States and Vermont to still hold that beacon up for having faith in ourselves and humanity that we can do this, and this is the best way to do it.
Do you feel like your thinking about democracy has changed? What have you learned about it? What have you realized? How do you think about it differently now than you might have when you were younger?
Well, it wasn't until I came to Vermont when I was 27 that I had the experience of really what direct democracy could be like. one of the challenges it faces across the country is as the population continues to grow, people feel more distant from their government and their representatives. In a big state, it's hard. You know, we're fortunate here in Vermont in that most of the people you vote for are people you've met or at least know a little bit about. I can see where around the country that's not it. But moving to Vermont was a huge thing. It's imperative that we continue to stay connected with constituents and that people can connect with them. The real change, I think, in recent history was the first time I really felt that was threatened, and that was when it was 4 years ago when the attempted coup fortunately failed. But it was the first time I thought, wow, these people were ready to take democracy over, to go against the will of the voters, and to utilize the practices that are used in so many other countries when a dictator comes in and takes over, contrary to the will of the people. So that was the first time I really felt it was at risk. And I know we have problems with how it works and whether it works and people feeling disenfranchised or not that they're getting what they want. But what I found in Vermont is generally people don't always have to get their way, but they do want to feel like they've been listened to. And that may be one of the challenges across the country is how do you get people to feel like they're being listened to? You know, usually, if you look at, I'm just looking at the last 50 years, the party in power generally swings back and forth. And I think we've had pretty much equal Republican and Democratic presidents over the last 50 years and the 40-something years I've been in Vermont, we've alternated from a Democrat to a Republican governor. So that pendulum does swing back and forth, and hopefully that gives people some sense that their ideas and wishes are being listened to. But it'll be interesting to see with this new administration coming in how that works and whether in 4 years the same peaceful transition of power happens that did yesterday. You know, Congress certified the election of the incoming president and went off without a hitch, which was very different than what happened 4 years ago.
I like to think of myself as a person who assumes the best of people, that people are doing what they think is right. But in the past few years, I feel like I've been forced to acknowledge that there are a lot more people than I ever expected who actually don't support democratic ideals. They don't want a pluralistic society. They really do believe in things like white supremacy or
patriarchy.
Right? Or that people of different religions or political views are their enemies. So, what do people who care about democracy do when they share a country with people who are explicitly anti-democratic?
I'm glad you recognize that, because I think that's something that we need to pay attention to right now. But it's also something that's happened before. You know, if you go back to the 1860s, what Northerners call the Civil War and some Southerners call the incursion of the North into the South had us fighting and killing each other. And if you go back just about 100 years ago, there was a similar bent on some real fundamentalist people and others who were looking to be more compassionate and democratic. And, you know, one instance I point to is on how this can turn out good when we don't think it always does. At the time, there was a public figure called Father Lachlan, and he was a very popular radio personality, probably listened to by 20 or more percent of the population of the country. And he was a real rabble-rouser and somebody who was looking for power and looking to bring people into power that did not adhere to democratic principles. And there was a minister in New York City named Harry Emerson Fosdick. And his famous sermon is still looked at today. It's called "Shall the Fundamentalists Win?" And it was so controversial, it got him fired from the church he was preaching to. The offshoot of that was that some of the other parishioners came and said, "Come with us. We'll build you a church." And among those was a Mr. Rockefeller, who mostly paid for the church, and which turned into what's today the Riverside Church in New York, which is a bastion of social justice and ecumenicalism. And one of the stipulations Rockefeller said is, we want this church to be non-denominational. The good thing that came out of that was, I think it shined a light on what the fundamentalists were trying to do then, and that the majority of people really didn't agree. Similarly now, I think the majority of people don't agree, and you know, even though that we have a new president, I don't believe that his hardcore support is based on his ideals, but more the transactional piece of, what are you going to do for us economically? And I think that was the key to this last election, is that people felt economically they were struggling to the degree that they weren't able to look too high on Maslow's hierarchy of needs and fell back to the most basic needs. I would dare say that if he doesn't deliver, those same people are not going to be there in his corner. The challenge is making sure they don't establish ways to continue a minority rule. When I saw him in office last time, it was the first time I saw dynamics similar to what was in South Africa for apartheid, or in Eastern Europe now, or in South American countries, where people went into office with the idea to stay there for a very long time. And trying to have faith that our system will continue to pull through. Going back to my point, we've been there before. I think we'll get through this again. Hopefully this will usher in even a better age than what we've had over the relative peace and prosperity since the end of World War II.
Your hope is refreshing for me personally, but also I think a lot of people are tired and overwhelmed. A lot of folks are ready to throw in the towel. Do you ever feel that? When you do, what keeps you going?
I don't feel that much. I am about doing the work, keeping going, and I don't have the perspective that what we're in is anything that isn't insurmountable. And part of it, I think, is the connections I have and we have as community. When we work with youth, one of the things we try and instill them is qualities that are resilient, that help them get through. I know when we talk about what's the best way to keep kids away from alcohol, tobacco, and other drugs, we try and create situations where the kids get their outer and inner needs met in their community, in their family, and it helps them withstand the ups and downs of life. And I think likewise for communities, the fact that we have communities here, that we are connected, it really is a healthy thing for us, and it leads me to think that we've been working through some tough stuff for a long time, and we will continue to. I think we continue to look at some of the big picture things that once we get through the clouds of the economic problems we had after COVID, you know, we're still looking at the realities of climate change and climate chaos. The things we need to do to get through that, I'm confident we will. I don't know that we're doing it on the timelines that some people would like us to see, but I think we will. And I continue to have faith in ourselves that we'll keep working together, and that's the key. On the other hand, you have a president who's been an expert on dividing us and makes it easier for minority opinions to get in. I think as we come together again and figure out how we need to move forward, I think we will. I think people would rather be working together, would rather not be in conflict, and want to enjoy peace and prosperity. I think it comes down to those two things. People don't want constant conflict in their life. I think we'll continue to move towards that light.
There are probably lots of reasons for this breakdown in discourse, but one of them is this lack of faith that our neighbors can be convinced by reason. Social scientists have documented how humans actually use reason more to justify their biases than to uproot them. And I think there's also this tendency where people look at people that we disagree with and think that they are so far gone in misinformation and conspiracy theories that there isn't hope or there isn't reason to try and convince people. How do we continue toward a government that's based on listening and common ground and compromise when we're finding it so hard to listen to each other right now?
Well, the simple answer is we need more women in government, but that's going to take a while. So I think the margin that Trump was elected was by men who could not vote for a woman. And you look at the economic pieces, and a lot of people voted for that, but I think there were cultural demographics that are so entrenched in patriarchy, they could not vote for a woman. And I think big picture, that's the swing that's happening, that we are moving towards a more balanced society where women have more power and more say. And there's been a pushback from the entrenched patriarchy that they're not ready to give up power. But I think they're dinosaurs, and they've got one foot in the tar pit. And we may have taken a step backwards, but we're going to take two steps forward. And that's the simple answer. The more complex answer is we need to be more intentional about reaching out. I know as a Democrat, we need to be more intentional about reaching out to all demographics. And there was a lot of discourse in this last that Democrats were seen as elitists who didn't know how to relate to people, as they say, who shower after work and who have dirt under their fingernails. And there's something to that. We need to do better around that. And I think we will. The other piece is we need to be more intentional, because we're in an economic situation where a lot of us can self-select where we live, and we tend to self-select to homogeneous demographic areas. One of the opportunities for climate may be that we're going to be forced to work together more and better. Sometimes those harsh realities can help. When I look back to in national government, when we had what I think are some of our better years of working together and bipartisanship, if you look at Congress after World War II, most of the people were veterans who had worked together during the war, regardless of labels. And then when they got to Congress, the labels didn't matter as much because they had experience of working together for common cause. And I think we've lost some of that, too. The intentionality of how we work together is going to be one of the challenges of the future. But I think as more and more people experience it and see how gratifying it can be to actually get to know more of your neighbors, to work together, to feel like you're not alone or isolated, that can be a real powerful dynamic to set in place for the future. But we're struggling to get there now, and part of it is because there are some people who are expert at wedge issues dividing us and keeping us separate. But I think at some point people will get tired of that, and I'll share a quick story of hope, I think, for what may seem intractable situations. Last year, the president of the Irish Senate visited the legislature in Vermont, and he was there to follow up on some visits from American legislators the year before to finalize a trade agreement between Vermont and Ireland. And he shared this story that the reason he was there is because the year before there were hundreds of Irish-American legislators who were invited to Ireland to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Peace Accords. And he said right until they were signed, he and many others felt like this was never going to happen. This was hundreds of years of bloodshed, of conflict, of attempted genocide. This wasn't going to be solved, ever. And yet it was. And 25 years later now, the peace is holding. And he said part of it is people were just tired of the bloodshed. They were tired of the constant conflict, and they were ready for something else. And hopefully it won't take hundreds of years for us to get to that place, but I think there is a point, whether it's the Middle East or some of the conflicts in Africa or Asia, people get tired of that level of conflict, bloodshed, and when they realize there's something better, they want to hold on to it. And it's happening in Ireland right now, and it's only been 25 years, but it's been 25 years where some people now who are growing up don't really know what the troubles were.
One last question. iHeart This is here to shine a light on things that people take for granted, or things that are wonderful, but we just tend not to see. Are there things in your life that you've taken for granted, you think, about democracy that you've come to later appreciate because of an experience that's happened to you? Or are there blessings of democracy that you are kind of in a unique position to see, considering your place in state government, that people like me might not even know about?
Well, the first thing that I would offer is that we live in a state where your government really is accessible. And I encourage people regularly come up to the State House, see what's happening. It may not be exciting like some other entertainment options you have out there, because 90% of what we do is nuts and bolts stuff. It's bread and butter stuff. It's roads and bridges, and it's not high-powered policy that may be a change in direction, but that's the reality of what we do. And it's there. It's accessible to everyone. you have to make a little bit of an effort. Although with all of our proceedings now are broadcast on YouTube and they're recorded, so you can check it out. The reality is, if it's going to work, though, we need people to be informed and participate. I mean, democracy doesn't just happen. It is something that can be a harsh reality sometimes, but it's like the Joni Mitchell song goes, you don't know what you got till it's gone. Could slip away. It is a delicate balance to keep what we are. I've come to realize how accessible government and your elected representatives are. We are there, and we really encourage that participation, because that's when democracy really works. Whether we get our way or not, if we have faith in the system, we'll do well as a country and individuals.
I was thinking a lot about the Buddhist monk and activist Thich Nhat Hanh. I saw him speak once, and he reminded his audience of how pleasant it was to have a non-toothache. You know, I have a mouthful of non-toothaches right now, which are invisible to me. Sometimes I think that the wonderful things about democracy are like non-toothaches. They're about all of these things that just don't happen to us and that we forget happen to people who don't live with the blessings of democracy.
I think it's a great analogy, and you know, if you just look at the human body, the millions of things that happen each day for us to continue to exist, and we do. Government can be like that. We're not aware of everything, but there's lots of things that are going on that help things happen, and they're important. Sometimes we have to pay more attention, but also appreciate not take for granted those non-toothaches. You know, Winston Churchill said, democracy is the worst form of government there is, except for all the rest. It's certainly not perfect, but it's malleable and can continue to change. And that's why we write laws on paper. We don't put them in stone. And we have the flexibility within a structure that we can do things to address things as they change with a basis for what worked in the past. So that's, for me, a hopeful thing.
Hey, Mike, thank you so much for sitting down and talking about this with me.
Thank you for your ongoing work with this. I appreciate the positivity you bring, and I think it's a light that can shine the way forward.
Hey, dear listeners, we've never done an interview on I Heart This before, and would love to know what you think. Should we do more? Is there someone you think would be great to talk to us? Let us know. You can email Ben at iheartthispodcast.com or let us know on our Facebook page. I Heart This is written, edited, and produced by me, Ben Lord. Our logo was designed by Brian Imaro Cribbs. Our theme song is used with permission from neosounds.com. Special thanks, of course, to Mike Merwicki and to the folks at the Sweet Spot Cafe. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, be kind, be curious, and be thankful.